Let us cultivate the altruistic motivation, seeking complete enlightenment for the sake of liberating infinite kind mother sentient beings. With that kind of bodhicitta motivation, that we should all participate in this teaching.
Can we come over here? Yes. Ta ni ngoran somalo ta pe yani endo tengu ye chila ni dajak ta ma shadi thaba ni ko ta ta lo ni tonga jak ko le ndu shi ni chi gi na shi ni ani tambi shur bi su ngo res.
One of the things that we all need to reflect on often is this, that over 2,500 years ago, Shakyamuni Buddha, our historical teacher, appeared in India.
So that, and then,
Buddha appeared in India and he performed what we generally talk about as 12 principal deeds of Shakyamuni Buddha.
That Sanjay Kangajin, that Sanjay Kamdidi, no, Mandi, Sanjay was Jabata, Karibu, and ran so many jewelry.
When we look at Shakyamuni Buddha, how he became Buddha, and what did he do first, and what did he do in the, you know, what did he do in the middle, and what did he achieve at the end? There are three things we could see, and which are also applicable to any one of us or anybody who is interested to become a complete enlightened person called Buddha. So the first thing he did was he cultivated the altruistic mind of enlightenment, or bodhicitta, samjujisem. That's the first thing he did. And then with that kind of altruistic motivation or state of mind, in the middle, as we would say, he pursued the fulfillment of two types of accumulation: accumulation of merit, positive energy, and accumulation of insight or wisdom for three great countless eons. That's what he did in the middle. So then what did he achieve at the end? So eventually, as a result of all those things he did, first cultivating bodhicitta, and then fulfilling the two types of accumulation, finally he became a complete enlightened person called Buddha. So that's what he achieved. So any one of us who would like to be a Buddha, this is the process, if you will, that we need to follow.
So
Now one could pose a question here. You can say, like, you know what? Isn't there a different, you know, way to get to the complete enlightened state? There's a faster route to get there. You know, I heard that there's something called Tantra or Mantrayana or Vajrayana, where you said that, you know, you have those techniques available, and if you follow them, that it is possible for an individual to become a Buddha in the short lifespan of this very life. Okay, now that seems like you don't have to go through three great countless eons, you know, whatever that means, you know, that's a long way. So that seems to be like a shortcut, you know, route. So what about that? Well, the answer to that is yes. There are such techniques called esoteric or tantric techniques that could possibly help one to become a Buddha in one lifetime, but one completely needs a different way of thinking. One has to restructure the whole way of thinking, and that's what's involved in that. Now, whether we look from what is called discourse perspective or Sudrayana perspective of Buddhism, or whether we look at from tantric perspective or Vajrayana perspective of Buddhism, the fact of the matter here is that in order to become a Buddha, one must accumulate merited wisdom that is worth of three great countless eons. Okay. Now the difference in these two perspectives is that from discourse perspective, it takes three great countless eons literally to fulfill the two types of accumulation. But if one were to follow the tantric path of perspective, it cuts short the time that is needed to complete the two types of accumulation. So it takes much less time, but one has to accumulate the merit and wisdom that is what are called, you know, equivalent to taking three countless eons to fulfill that.
Trans hakover was lagwe lega leya te nen dawa chig leya te mishi ya zambo chig levin ta nyami nyusum te lega chagu yor te nangi lees.
So I think we can find many examples to talk about, illustrate the difference between the Sudrayana perspective or the discourse perspective and the tantric perspective here. It's like, let's say, you know, we are going to, you know, manufacture something, and that involves using our hands. So if we're going to use our hands, it might take 1 month or 2 months to finish the thing. But now if we have a technology, that might take us, you know, an hour or a millisecond, we don't know. So it's faster. So that's what we're talking about. But the thing here to remember is whether you use your hands and take like in 3 months or 4 years or whatever to finish the thing, or whether you use a technology in a nanosecond, you finish it. But things that we need to finish the task, you know, and how can we do it within, I mean, most effectively? And that's the difference we're talking about. So if we have the, you know, the latest technology, it might take a nanosecond to finish a task, but it has to finish a task, you know, to get what we want. And if it has to use the hand, it may take ages to finish it. So what I just told you in a nutshell is that in order to become a complete enlightened being called Buddha, one must fulfill or complete the two types of accumulation. You know, that may take three great countless eons, or they may take a shorter time, but one has to fulfill the two types of accumulation of merit and wisdom. But in order to be able to do that, first, we need to cultivate the altruistic mind of enlightenment or bodhicitta, bodhisattva's attitude or the heart. So if you're wondering, you know, what is somebody doing for three great countless eons accumulating merit and wisdom, what does that really mean? You know, what is involved here? What is really involved here is, in order to become an enlightened being, we must, that is M-U-S-T and underlined, and there's a must. We must get rid of the two types of mental obscuration. One is called delusions, okay, kleshyas, and other is called obscuration to omniscience or knowledge. So we need to get rid of those two types of mental obscuration from within ourselves, and it's for that we fulfill the accumulation of merit and wisdom, which may take three great countless eons, or may not.
Yes.
So our historical teacher Shakyamuni Buddha, first he generated the altruistic mind of enlightenment. Of course there are different explanations how he did that, you know, or there are stories, you know, how he did that, maybe different versions of the story. Now if we were to rely upon a particular sutra which is titled as Repaying the Kindnesses, okay, that's the title of the sutra, Tilen Sabedo. And in that sutra it is mentioned that once upon a time when Shakyamuni Buddha was like as ordinary like anybody else, and he was in hell, okay, and he was suffering like anybody else around him, and at that time he couldn't bear the suffering that he witnessed that all other fellows are suffering. So at that moment he generated the compassion, the altruism at that moment. So this is the one story or the version explanation how did or when did our Buddha generated altruism. But in another sutra, which is titled as Sutra of Fortunate Aeon, meaning that during this fortunate aeon, 1,000 enlightened beings would manifest in the world. So that's what the sutra is talking about, how each of the Buddha, 1,000 Buddha, generated altruism. Now in that sutra, it is mentioned that once upon a time, Shakyamuni Buddha was a poor fellow, and then it is in the presence of another enlightened being by the name called Mahashakyamuni, Shakya Thubjen, he offered a cup of porridge. Okay, and then he generated the altruistic attitude. So I think that would be sufficient for today. At least two different sutras I mentioned, and each of them telling us how did Shakyamuni Buddha generate altruism initially. But more important perhaps to remember here is what does altruism mean, generating bodhicitta mean, what does it really mean? What it really means is that we develop this commitment in our mind that I'm going to seek complete enlightened state in order to benefit all other sentient beings. Okay, when we generate that kind of attitude, and that involves commitment, okay, and that's what we call generating bodhicitta. So I'm generating altruism, the kind of altruism Buddha generated, that as I just said involved a strong commitment, and it's not by simply wishing for something, you know, it's like how nice it would be if I become Buddha for the sake of all others, okay, and then it's just kind of a wish, you know, there was no commitment involved, it's just a nice thing to think about, not that much, you know. Buddha said that I really want to become Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings, and I'm going to commit myself to that. Okay, so that altruistic, which involved with the commitment, is something very instrumental in his spiritual growth. So once an individual genuinely cultivates that kind of altruism which involves commitment, when you really have bodhicitta, the first initial moment of bodhicitta, it could be, then he or she, or in this case Shakyamuni Buddha, he reached the path of accumulation of greater vehicle Buddhism, or Bodhisattva's way of life. See, in Buddhism, we talk about five spiritual paths in any vehicles. So in Mahayana Buddhism, or Bodhisattva's way of life, there are five paths, from the path of accumulation to the path of normal learning. Now that's my first footnote here. Okay. So while you are on the, now I just mentioned how do you get on the path of accumulation of bodhisattvas, right? So while you are on the path of accumulation and the path of preparation, which is the next path, okay, one completes the accumulation of merit and wisdom for the first great countless eon. So while he was on the path of accumulation and the path of preparation, he honored and made offerings to like countless enlightened beings, other enlightened beings, and received teachings from countless Buddhas, all those things are involved in this, and fulfilled the accumulation of merit and wisdom for the first great countless eon. And then from the path of seeing, which is the third path, and all the way to the seventh spiritual ground of a bodhisattva. Maybe add another footnote here, because from the path of seeing to the path of meditation, we also talk about 10 spiritual grounds of a bodhisattva called Dashabhumi. Okay, and this is what we're talking about. So from the path of seeing all the way up to the seventh spiritual ground of bodhisattva, one fulfills the accumulation of merit and wisdom for the second great countless eon. That's what Shakyamuni Buddha did. When an individual reaches the path of seeing, or attains the path of seeing, one sees emptiness non-conceptually. In other words, the person sees emptiness as it is, without the network of the conceptions. One sees it directly or nakedly, as we would say. This is what the Buddha saw emptiness directly on the path of seeing. So on the path of seeing, which is the third path, one starts to get rid of obscuration to omniscience, okay, by way of integrating method and wisdom. The wisdom here is the wisdom realizing emptiness as it is, and the method is the altruistic attitude of bodhicitta. So by combining altruism and the wisdom, from the path of seeing, one starts to get rid of obscuration to omniscience.
Mm-hmm. 다 쌓는 거 아니에요?
And then from the eighth spiritual ground of a Bodhisattva, now don't mix the ground and the path together, okay, that's why I'm just trying to keep things clearly in my translation. So from the eighth spiritual ground to the tenth spiritual ground of a Bodhisattva, these three grounds, 8, 9, 10, are called pure spiritual grounds, okay? Pure spiritual grounds, on these, you know, three paths, one fulfills the accumulation of merit and wisdom for the third great countless eon. And that's what Buddha did. So this explanation I just gave you, how Shakyamuni Buddha completed accumulation of merit and wisdom for three great countless eons on the five paths and the ten spiritual ground. Of course, this is presented from Mahayana perspective. Now, if you look, how one could become a Buddha from the Theravadin perspective, I think they will also agree that in order to become a Buddha, first one must generate bodhicitta or altruism.
Okay.
So they would say that yes, one must first accumulate, first generate altruism or bodhicitta, but that the way an individual fulfills merit and accumulation for three great countless eons, there has, they have a little slightly different explanation, perhaps different or not. What they say is that during the first great countless eon, an individual makes offerings to and renders services to as many as 75,000 enlightened beings or Buddhas. Okay? Yeah. When you honor, and this time my math is absolutely correct, okay, you don't have to doubt it, it is 75,000. 75,000 Buddhas, because math is this strange discipline that sometimes can get messed up, but this time it's right. 75,000 Buddhas, you make offerings to and you honor them and you receive teachings from them, then you fulfill the accumulation of the first great countless eon. So from my inner perspective, in order to accumulate merit and wisdom, you make offerings to countless enlightened beings. You see, the number was countless. But here, from the, Theravadin perspective, the number is kind of an exacting number in some sense. This is, okay, 75,000,
Buddhas.
And then during the the second great countless eon, according to Theravadin perspective, I'm using the probably politically correct term here, I said Theravadin perspective, according to many Buddhist old literature, it's called Hinayana, okay? But then some have issues with that. So I just want to mention that. So according to that perspective, during the second great countless eon, an individual makes offerings to and receives teachings and so on, to as many as 76,000 Buddhas, so 1,000 Buddhas more, okay? And then during the third great countless eon, he or she, or individual practitioner, makes offerings to, receive teachings from, and so on, to as many as 77,000 Buddhas. And that's how you complete the accumulation of merit and wisdom for the third great countless eon.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Theravadan perspective, you know, you will spend 100 eons accumulating merit to be able to actualize what is called the enlightened signs or the marks. Because the Buddha has, you know, major and minor signs of realization. So in order to realize those signs, one has to accumulate merit for 100
eons.
From Mahayana perspective or greater vehicle perspective, a bodhisattva on the 10th spiritual ground, okay? So this bodhisattva is referred to as the one who is on the last Chintavati, who is in the last, well, this is where it gets technical, and I don't know where to get around with that one. So this is called a Bodhisattva. Let me technically translate it and then translate the explanation, and that gives you the meaning, and just forget about the eloquence of the translation. This Bodhisattva is called, the Bodhisattva on the 10th ground is called the Bodhisattva on the last continuum. Okay, what the heck does that mean, last continuum? This is where the explanation comes. Last continuum means that, you see, this Bodhisattva is at this particular moment still has what we call the continuum of being an ordinary person, ordinary being. So once you transcend this ground, you are no more ordinary being. Okay, that's what we mean, that the last continuum of being ordinary or ordinariness. Okay, if there's no such word, let's make one there. So the process involves that Bodhisattva on the 10th ground, before he or she enters into this deep meditation, right, still is not completely enlightened. There's ordinariness, you know, there, retained. So once you enter into deep meditation called meditative equipoise or emptiness, and when you come out of this meditation, you are already an enlightened being. Now you are no more ordinary. So why is that? Because while you are in this deep meditation, you are, you know, you have internalized the most powerful antidote to get rid of the remnants of the two mental obscuration, delusions and obscuration to omniscience. So because that antidote is present, it has really removed those. Once you come out of that meditation, now you're completely free of delusions and obscuration to omniscience. So therefore, you are a complete enlightened or awakened person. Now, the next thing, you know, if you're wondering, like, okay, so is there a particular location where, you know, one first becomes a Buddha, or is there such things exist? Yes, you know, when first one becomes a Buddha, in a very pure land called, in the Sanskrit, called Agnishta Pure Land. So as Geshe-la quoted relevant lines from a sutra, which you know, tell us that when you become Buddha, you know, first, okay, you will become Buddha in this particular location, if you like. It's called Agnishta Pure Land. Okay. So what happens is that the main source, as we would say, becomes a Buddha in Agnishta Pure Land. Now this main source might have many emanations in other parts of the world. Okay. So when you become Buddha in the Agnishta Pure Land as the main source of all this emanation, all these emanations in the other part of the world also become Buddha at the same time. So what we see in our human world, if somebody is becoming Buddha, this is an emanation of a, you know, somebody else who is in Agnishta Pure Land becoming Buddha.
Flat on the
So let's refocus on Shakyamuni Buddha, because we are today spending time to understand his life a little bit more, or to remember his kindnesses to us. Before he came to this world, Shakyamuni Buddha was in Tushita Buddha field. So that means there were other celestial beings as companions. So Shakyamuni Buddha was in Tushita Buddha field, and then he decided that it was the right time to manifest in the human world, meaning this world particular. There could be humans in other worlds, but this particular world. So when he made that decision and he appeared in this world, then we said that he performed 12 main deeds or principal deeds. In a general sense, it is very, for an ordinary person, it's just impossible to talk about the qualities and the deeds of an enlightened being. That's just beyond our abilities and skills. Even it is said that for Buddhas to describe each other's qualities, that may not necessarily be easy to do. Okay. So that being said, so we just we focus on 12 main deeds of Shakyamuni Buddha.
Tal ko aneta igela ne gandig ne le gudu tani ko chel tamatokar shugaris tamatokar.
So when Buddha was in Tushita Buddha field, that was before he came down here, he was known by the name called Tambatokarbo. So when Buddha decided to manifest in our world, so he had to come from Tushita Buddha field down to our world. So that is counted as the first principal deed. That's called the descent from Tushita Buddha field. So if somebody is wondering why do we count that as a principal deed, coming down from Tushita down to the human world, but the thing is that Shakyamuni Buddha was in Tushita Buddha field, not sitting idly there, as if he has nothing better to do. I mean, he was teaching, many divine beings there, or celestial beings, so he benefited an innumerable number of beings spiritually, and then he thought it was at the right time to come down to this human world and benefit more sentient beings here, so that's why we count Buddha's coming down from Tushita to our world as a principal deed. And then the second principal deed, second in a sense, is what we call conceiving in the womb of mother. Okay? And of course, Buddha before came down, it's not like, he randomly came down to the human world. He thought about all the things, is this the right time? And where should I be? And who should be my mother? And so on. So there are so many things involved. Now we're not going to talk about every tidbit things. There's no time. To cut short all that story, the second principal deed is conception in the womb of mother. So I may not have enough time to explain much about each of these principal deeds, but at least I want to sort of list the 12 principal deeds, And so conceiving conception. It's the second. The third one is the actual birth. Okay, that's another principal deed. So being born, literally. into the world. And then the next principle date has to do with how, you know, as a teenager or a young, you know, boy growing up, he has to go through the education system of the time. So he went through education, he learned about art and skills and all that. So that is considered as another principle
date.
Maybe I should tell a little bit about his education here. Of course, Shakyamuni Buddha, then he was not called Buddha. He was born in royal family, and his dad was a great Indian king by the name of King Suddhodana. And so he had the resources and the power to, you know, to bring the greatest of the experts and scholars, you know, available at that time in his kingdom and in the neighboring. So he invited the best of the experts and the teachers in different fields to tutor his son. So at the time, the young prince was called by the name of Siddhartha. Okay, and he was not called Buddha Shakyamuni. His name Siddhartha has this meaning that, you know, he fulfilled all the meaning or the purpose or the wishes of his mother. Okay, so since the time he conceived in the womb of the mother, whatever the mother wished for or she wanted, all the wishes were fulfilled, and from that is indicated his name, Siddhartha. So on the first day, you know, these experts, the teachers, you know, the best of the brain available at the time came and started to teach him. On the very first day, they taught him so many words or like this, like tens and thousands, but he learned everything and they were teaching him. So on the very first day, you know, whatever they started to teach, he just learned it right then and there, and then he said, you know, could you teach me something more? So then the teacher said, you know what, everything that I have learned in what is called in the linguistic discipline, maybe that's not linguistic discipline at the time, in the language and art, this is all there is to it to learn. So I told you everything I learned in that is there in this whole discipline. Then he came of the age, and his dad Suddhodana now wanted his son to get, you know, settled down, married, and, you know, rule the kingdom. And he has his plan for his son. No wonder he had. So he said, okay, time to get married. Yeah. And so looked for all these, you know, princesses everywhere, and brought a bunch of them, you know, to get married and to be his queen. You know, so that's considered as another principal deed.
And so his
one of the queens by the name, you know, who belonged to another Shakya clan, and by the name of Sasoma. Now this definitely is a Tibetan translation. I don't know what would be Sanskrit, but would it matter to you? Probably not. Yeah, I guess he wants to translate in English, you know. So ocean and earth, or something like that. Anyway, from their conjugation, they gave birth to a son called Rahula.
That zimi kozorun zeba kavarında zimi kozorun zebaşi ani jesizun zebaşi.
So then, of course, he kind of ruled for the kingdom for a while, a little bit. You know, that is considered as another principal deed because he administered, the kingdom for a while.
That any na ani shega na chifu dungi zipi on tan that time mungu kijua ina kiu shega na chifu dungi the zipi chui na ani ani ta wolo ni hizo gula ani jebi kan ta chosol pebris.
Tishik si wolo kien.
Kaje.
咱们中间的这个，对不对？这个，但是这样，他就参加人马上了，给，但是的，这个，但是这里，这是中间吧？哦，是，啊，这是曹操，OK。对，他的。Okay, and then at the age of 29, of course, he had a chance to get out of the walls of his kingdom because he was so protected, you know, and he, and this whole long story anyway.
I cut
down that one. And then there was about age 29, he saw some signs like people were getting sick and somebody was dying and da 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 and all that. And then he said, okay, this whole thing is making no sense and I'm going to renounce the royal life and going to go and pursue spirituality. So he renounced the royal life and he went into forest. So that was 29 years old. And then he became ordained, right? He left the royal life and he went into the forest and he took ordination and he became monastic. Now that is counted as a principal deed. And after his monastic ordination, and he went into 6 years of intensive retreat of some sort. It's called a penance, you know, a 6 years of really hardship. So he entered into 6 years of very hard, retreat life, tortured himself quite a bit, physically to an extent, and that didn't work out. Anyway, he then pursued his spirituality, and at the age of 35, he became an enlightened being. So he became Buddha. So if you go by the Tibetan lunar calendar, on the 15th day, which is the full moon day of the fourth month, that is the time he became an enlightened person. So he became Buddha at age of 35, and then he did not go and start to teach right away. So he sat in silence for 49 days. So he was thinking about, okay, is this the time to teach? If I teach, is anybody going to understand what I'm going to teach? Who should I teach first? And all these issues he thought about, sitting in silence for 49 days, and then he decided to teach. So which is considered as his first turning on the wheel of Dharma, or his first sermon, or his first teaching, and that was yesterday. Of course, he was not the first Buddha who ever came to this world. There were already three, ahead of him, and his three predecessors. So he thought about it. Where did they teach first? And all that. And so he realized that each of the three, predecessors, you know, gave their teaching, first teaching in Varanasi. Sarana. So he said, okay, that's where I'm going to go and teach. So as I mentioned a little earlier, that during this eon, we believe that there are going to be 1,000 Buddhas who would manifest in this world. Out of them, Shakyamuni Buddha is the fourth. Okay, now imagine that there are a lot more to come than who came already. And so each of them would perform, as we would say, the deed of becoming an enlightened being in Bodh Gaya, in the Indian state of Bihar, present right now. And they would give their first teaching in Varanasi, in the Uttar Pradesh state of India. Yeah. So that's how every Buddha, one of this, each of the 1,000 Buddha would do exactly the same thing. They would become Buddha in Bodh Gaya, and they would give the first teaching in Varanasi.
So the dark horn day, Varanasi came to the end. It is called Nema and Pala, and Yendu Sun, those Tanga day. That called the Lord Ruka Kashin and those Yudhisani, and they could be Toby Toyama, just because it.
So after 49 days of silence and thinking about everything, you know, what he should teach, where he should teach, and all of that, and then he went to Saranath Varanasi too. And this is where he met what we call now as the first five disciples of Buddha. These were actually the five attendants his dad sent to serve him, you know. But somehow when Buddha entered into six hardship years of retreat, they still thought, oh, that was too much, you know, I can't handle it. So let's move somewhere, I mean, leave this guy here. And they just went to Varanasi when Buddha was in Bodh Gaya at the time, and now they met. Okay, so Shakyamuni came and he ran into these five, you know, people here. So this group of five saw Buddha coming from a distance, so then they just had a quick conversation. Let's, you know what, the guy is coming from there. Let us not, you know, welcome him. None of us is going to stand up and pay respect to him and don't welcome him. Just let it be. Okay, that's what they can talk among themselves.
That Sanji to kill new person, Sanji Zijig Majefete, Pati Yalan Yante, Kanga Yalan Kujifi, and the Shamba Lexus, and those in the Peronase, and those securities.
But that's what they decided. They said, well, the guy is coming from there, let us not get up and pay respect or do any of those things and just leave him alone. But when Buddha approached, came closer to them, because of his presence, enlightened presence, one started to get up and pay respect, say, hello, nice to see you. And then everybody else started to get up like, howdy, you know. And so they all got up and respected and, you know, greeted him.
So that the name is Shintak, and the Kunzuta, Kyo Tambo Sunsati.
So then, I mean, these are the first, you know, main disciples, you know, where Buddha gave his first teaching, you know, to them. So they become his first five disciples. Now, if you wonder, like, you know, how come these five, you know, people who kind of rebel against him, you know, and left him alone and moved to somewhere else, you know, now they got to be the first, you know, disciples. Well, I mean, it seems like over many lifetimes they had that karmic connection built in, and so there was this auspiciousness, as we would say, created. So that's why they became, under the given situation, the first five disciples. Maybe I can tell you one story about these five and the connection to Buddha. You know, in some another lifetime, these five were born as five cubs of a tigress. Okay, there were these little cubs of a tigress.
So that consequently, that there is a that you have to have job of sales, then job of hinta chimu then that sales, then consequently, pinja sum shinduk shin, shumaris.
So that another time, Shakyamuni Buddha was born as the youngest prince of a royal, you know, family again. And the three brothers, they went into stroll into the forest, and you know, and Buddha was the youngest of the three at the time.
So that Kong Tiritan any Tatung about the Tamalanta Lucini. Ani Mopan Badekare Mopan Garani to Sanji becomes to Dusday and Tambul and Kunzule.
And of course, there's a long story behind it, but we have to cut it short again. The mother tigress, and the five cubs were dying of starvation. You know, they didn't get to eat anything for days. So the young prince really felt so much compassion for them, and somehow he tricked the other brothers, whatever, cut short the story, and he just fed himself to them, just feasted them. And then at that time he prayed honestly that this time I feed them with my body and blood, but eventually when I become a Buddha, may I be able to give them the first teaching so that they can taste the Dharma first time. Okay? That's what he prayed. Of course, when you look at the Buddha's many previous lifetimes, how he really sacrificed so much for the sake of Dharma, spiritual development, there are other stories like once Shakyamuni Buddha was a Brahmin, by the name of Brahmin of, you know, Shanti, means patience. And then there's a whole story about how the king got mad because his queens were all attracted to this, you know, funny guy here and not attracted to him anymore. He got so mad and he just chopped his limb and said, what the hell you are doing with my wives? And, you know, he said, well, I am, yogi, practitioner of patience. He said, yeah, okay, let me tell you one more. And just chop the other limb. He said, well, yeah, do whatever you like. I'm a patience person. So, I mean, he sacrificed a lot, you know, in spiritual pursuit in many lifetimes.
If you go into that, it's Jabu Chavarma. If you go into that,
So one of these five disciples, for example, they had many karmic connections with Buddha over many lifetimes. For example, the Kunshiku Dinaya, one of the five, you know, he was a king probably at the time. Maybe he was the angry king who did this to him, Buddha. So anyway, Buddha prayed that when eventually I become Buddha, may I be able to provide them the nectar of Dharma. Okay, so this is what, you know, happened.
That is it. Any, that didn't even any tangari. Any Kong loose in the time. Varanasin Sarnasin, what I can sing was Varanasin. Dinner pay church, pay the tiny any. No money, Kong is said to be sunga. Usunga, you to some shit. That you to don't make you lose in it. You to get those child. So that I give it to you, say any. Call that church, call it Tango de. Then show up on them,
And so Shakyamuni Buddha came to Varanasi, a particular place called Saranath in Varanasi, and he saw that there were, you know, the four seats, you know, three seats belonged to the three previous Buddhas, and there was one seat vacant for, so he sat on that seat and then he started to teach. So he paid his respect to the three other seats, you know, and he circumambulated them, and then he sat on the fourth one, and then he started to teach the Four Noble Truths. So Buddha gave his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths called Arya Satyas, you know, and usually that's what everybody says, yeah, Buddha gave Four Noble Truths teaching. Well, there's more to that, the way he taught it, you know, and that's even gets more complicated. And in his presentation, for example, Buddha defined the nature or the entity of each of the Four Noble Truths, Mola Deva. He talked about the functionality of the Four Noble Truths, you know, what good they do, you know, to serve. He talked about the outcome of the Four Noble Truths. So, I mean, he talked about the Four Noble Truths in many different ways. So first he simply introduced the Four Noble Truths. He said, this is the truth of suffering, this is the truth, the cause of suffering, this is the truth of cessation of suffering, and this is the true path leading to the cessation. So basically he tried to define each of the Four Noble Truths. So first he defined each of the Four Noble Truths, and then the next one he talked about, as we said, the functionality of the Four Noble Truths, meaning, like he said, truth of suffering is something that you should realize it. You must realize what true suffering means. But true cause of the suffering is that which you should abandon, get rid of. Okay? And true cessation of suffering is that you should actualize, you should really attain. And true path is something you should cultivate through meditation that leads you to the cessation. So he talked about the, you know, the Four Noble Truths from functional perspective. In other words, you know, he approached the Four Noble Truths from functional perspective, meaning that first thing first, we need to realize what true suffering is. If we don't realize this, we will never ever going to really wish to be free from suffering. You know, it's not going to work. We really don't know what suffering is, the scope of suffering and all that. So once we realize what suffering is, now we want to really get rid of it. And that's a natural thing to wish for. So then you say, okay, how can I get rid of a suffering? Then this is where Buddha said, abandon the true cause of suffering. Now we know, okay, to get rid of the suffering, you must get rid of its cause. So when Buddha said, you know, understand or realize suffering, if you are wondering, like, well, I know about the suffering quite a bit. Well, as a matter of fact, that's quite a bit. Not complete understanding of the suffering. Because if we think that, well, we know a lot about suffering problems, what we really know is still a very limited nature of suffering. Okay, we don't understand ins and out of suffering and every, you know, shapes of suffering. We don't. There are many forms of suffering. The kind of suffering that we know, and all kinds of suffering we know, pretty much belong to this particular category of suffering called suffering of misery, which basically means if you get a headache, you know you got a pain. Okay? And if you put your hand in a fire, you know it's going to burn you. Now it's really, you know, suffering. Or it's too hot, we know this is a suffering. It's too cold, we know it is painful. Okay? And house get burned down, there's a flooding and, you know, everything. These are all we see as suffering and we know it. But there are other forms of suffering we don't really know, such as suffering of change, you know, that we don't know. Pervasive suffering. The fact of the matter is that we are born, you know, in this particular situation with delusions and contaminated karmic action with all these aggregates. That is in the very nature of suffering, but we don't know. Yeah, Gisela, you can speak in English.
No, I can't. I can't. So, 제위동에 대해 가라서 하고 오면 더 왔어. 왜냐면 제위동에 대해 내가 그 대화 관리증이나 가라서 내가 그 대화 처음으로 제위동에 차고 가랬어.
So we don't know, you know, suffering of change, which includes all the things that we regard as pleasurable and, you know, feel good stuff, you know. All these things are in reality suffering. They are in the nature of change. Some of the kind of things we experience in our life, which might indicate what suffering or change is, like, you know, we feel too hot, so maybe, you know, we take off our clothes, or what, we take swim, or we put, you know, turn the air conditioning, whatever, feels so good, and we think, this is it. Well, stay for a while, now it's getting too cold. Okay, this is not working out fine. Okay, I need to put on more clothes, I'm going to crank up my, now, the heater or something, you do that, okay, that feels much better now. Well, then it gets too hot. Yeah, we're sitting down, feels very comfortable now. After a while, it started to, you know, give pain to, you know, the things we're sitting on. And, okay, I'm going to need to get up. Oh, that feels really good, relaxing my muscles, everything. And standing for a while, that, wow, this is painful now, I've got to sit down. See how all these things change, looks like good, feels comfortable now, pleasurable, it just in every minute, you know, becomes painful.
So that's it, eh? That's how I'm doing it, diligent. When I... 코에 내려 동해 가서 코에 내려 시에 시에 반 중대 차원 두지 동해 나고 있어. 니인데 생 개개 요 말이 코에 내려 마설지 봐도 차원 두지 동해 나디고 있어.
So now if you think that suffering will change is something difficult to understand, which we don't understand much. Now the pervasive suffering is even all the more difficult for us to understand, because this what this means is that as long as our rebirth in samsara or civil existence is precipitated by delusions and contaminated karmic actions, no matter wherever we are, what form we have, our aggregates are contaminated and they are in the nature of suffering. Okay. Now that we don't realize it. So we need to educate ourselves about the different levels of suffering and know about all these different landscapes of suffering, suffering of misery, suffering of change, pervasive suffering. And when we truly realize, understand this, it's okay, I've got enough of that. Now I really want to get out of suffering. Then we say, okay, how do I do that? We need to abandon the causes of suffering. Practically, there are two: delusions and contaminated karmic actions. So this is what we always need to keep in our mind, that when we engage in the study of Dharma or spirituality, we cultivate spirituality, do whatever practice we do, small, moderate, big, you know, study, practice. It does not matter. Whatever we are doing, we should see that it is really affecting or counteracting our delusions and contaminated karmic actions. That should be the goal. You know, we study a little bit of Dharma, well, that should be targeted at counteracting our delusions and contaminated karmic actions. We do big studies, okay, that should also be focused on counteracting delusions and contaminated karmic actions. So that should be our goal.
And while
Buddha is known for turning what is called the three wheels of Dharma, or he gave three different sets of teachings. And I think I'll just run through this list again quickly because of time, that he gave his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths. He gave his second teaching on wisdom gone beyond, or transcendental wisdom. It's called Prajna Paramita teachings, in a place called Vulture's Peak, Girthkuti. Where is it now? In the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh, I think. near Bodh Gaya, by the way.
Kolo Baba Gojane, any Chetana, Denba Yumita, the next Chever Machine, and they made some worries. Chetamchi.
So in during his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, Buddha did not make any kind of a subtle distinctions between do things exist truly or not truly, or you know, any of those distinctions. He just simply said, nothing exists truly.
Okay. I call somebody any young bakin, nay young bakin any leper number shavi chunkorosinte and those equal numbers.
But he did that during his third round of teaching, or the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, in a place called Vaishali in India. And this is where he really tried to differentiate between different characteristics of phenomena. Okay, now he started to differentiate what really truly exists, what don't exist, and he started to make the distinctions. So if we follow the line of thought in what is called Unraveling Thought Sutra, Dode Kongdel, Unraveling Thought Sutra, then Buddha said, all imputed phenomena are without, they do not exist by way of their own characteristics. They do not exist by way of their own characteristics, but dependent phenomena and thoroughly established phenomena, I know I'm throwing a lot of terms here, do exist by way of their own characteristics. Now you see how he started to make a distinction between different characteristics of phenomena.
Yes. That the nigga color rumba sum corn do see corn. And then it tagar said, and it could color cause it. That the nigga tagun in the years of a temper.
So Buddha gave three, sets of teachings, then of course, at the end of his life, he passed into Parinirvana, or he passed away. That's another principle deed. So when we talk about Buddha passing away, it's very different from ordinary persons pass away. Okay, we need to understand that. That's why we try to use the word language called Parinirvana, what that really means is that, as it is said in a sutra called the Golden Light Sutra, that enlightened beings never die. There's no such thing as an enlightened being, dies at a certain period of time. But what happens is they may decide to dissolve their physical forms in a particular world system and then move to another world system. That's what they do. So when Shakyamuni Buddha, we said, passed away, what we really mean is he said, I'm going to dissolve my physical form here, but, that does not mean he really died. Okay, he is manifesting in some other world systems. So in the sutra it says, Buddhas never die and Dharma never disappears. So these 12 principal deeds of Shakyamuni Buddha that I just very briefly talked about, or even I just kind of highlighted them, these are the what we call the important deeds of a Buddha's life when he manifested in our world system. I'm not talking about Buddha's activities in some other world systems, Because enlightened beings have such capacity that they can manifest themselves in a billion world systems and can perform billions of actions all at the same time. So, can we ever finish talking about them, even can talk, start to talk about them? That's just impossible to do. So if you take time and use the logic and use the reasoning and all that, there are a lot of avenues, that we can explore and, investigate Buddha's life and deeds. More importantly, what we really need to do is try to, if you will, try to extract the essence of Buddha's teachings. Because he taught so many things, but what are the essence of Buddha's teachings? So we should try to get hold of them. So what are we talking about here? Shakyamuni Buddha himself made it very clear. He said, never accumulate any kind of negativity. So there is no, basically no excuse. If something is negative, in a sense, do not do it. You know, don't do it. Okay? And Kewa Pusum Thoba said, accumulate the wealth of virtue. If something is positive, you know, beneficial, constructive, we should do that. So if you try to look at what does it mean, never accumulate negativity. I mean, how do we accumulate negativity? Mostly in relation to sentient beings, isn't it? So this basically means that we must not, you know, harm sentient beings either physically or verbally or mentally. Do not hurt others, you know, through our actions of body, speech and mind. Accumulate the wealth of virtue. Of course, there are many virtues or positive actions we can do, but among them, some of the greatest ones that we can do is cultivate compassion for sentient beings, cultivate love for sentient beings, cultivate altruism for sentient beings. So these are some of the most powerful virtues that we can accumulate and bring benefit to others, because we really care about other sentient beings. So in one stanza, those are the first two lines of the stanza, you know, never accumulate negativity, accumulate the wealth of virtue. Then the third line says, thoroughly subdue our mind or tame our mind. And that's the most important thing to do, because our mind is not tamed, it is deluded, it's unruly, it is crazy, it is, you know, weird, whatever. So now we need to make it normal and, you know, subdued and positive. So that's the most important thing to do. So when we talk about taming our mind, basically means we need to transform our mind, because certain state of our mind brings us a lot of suffering that we don't want. Okay, we run through so many headaches, but certain state of mind brings us joy and happiness and peace that we like and we want. Okay, so considering what we want and we don't want, so it is vital and essential for us to subdue our mind or change our mind so that we get what we want, peace, happiness, you know, and goodness, because all the feelings that we go through are happening in our mind. Okay, so if we train our mind, then we are really able to stop the suffering and we're able to get, you know, what we want. And then he concludes this line by the last line of the stanza says, this is the teaching of Buddha. This is the doctrine of Buddha. Okay, this is the advice I could give you. And if you want the advice, here's the one. Okay? So yesterday was, the Buddha's turning of the first wheel of Dharma. And so because of that, in order to commemorate that and honor that and remember Buddha's kindnesses, so today I just spend time talking about Buddha's life a little bit and his deeds.
Yes. So that kind is that are the that is earning a kind of how did you keep this? And the region the that part is the Kina.
Of course, I have not been able to do justice within the given time, you know, to Buddha. There's so much more to learn about Buddha's life stories, and I just kind of highlighted things here. And so once we really learn more about Buddha's life and what he did, then I think that really becomes very inspirational for us. You know, that gives us the inspiration in our spiritual quest and all that. So that is very important for us to study more about Buddha's life.
Yes. That ring tower came with the natural to do sing around someone who is a city, David, the Hidaki. Yeah, for his gives us iris, gets a star, isn't it? Someone who.
So today is another hot day and it's humid, and but you all have been very patient and smiling and, you know, so very nice. So I think we all met quite a good effort here to participate in the teaching, and we have definitely created or accumulated, you know, positive energy. So it is very good that, you know, we have come together, we have, you know, bear the heat of the day, and so we have accumulated certain merit, and we don't want our merit or the positive energy to go waste. So we want to do an altruistic dedication of our merit. And so we do that, as you know it already very well, we dedicate our merit for the flourishing of Dharma, the source of benefits and happiness throughout the universe. May His Holiness the Dalai Lama and all other great holy masters, wherever they are in any part of the world and universe, may they live long and be successful in fulfilling their visions, benefiting sentient beings. May spiritual communities throughout the world and spiritual practitioners from all traditions remain healthy, harmonious, and be successful in fulfilling their spiritual aspirations. May these and other world environments be free of all kinds of unwanted pains and problems, and beings find peace, happiness, prosperity, and spirituality. Last but not least, we dedicate our collective merit for all kind mother sentient beings to be free from the fears and dangers of two types of mental obscuration, delusions, and imprints of delusions, which are obscuration to omniscience, you know, and then maybe all reach complete enlightened state quickly.
Shabbat Shalom. Sanjay